This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, the story of Ian Burkhart. That is a man living with paralysis who was able to regain movement of his hands. Have you been following that story? Using a computer wired to his brain. We're going to hear from Ian himself on what it was like to relearn to move his arm and hands. But first, lots of companies are trying to find ways to bring the internet to remote places. You got Facebook trying free basics in India. Wikipedia is testing a project in Angola. And of course, there's Project Loon, and that's Google's network of high-altitude balloons. Well, the U.S. government has its own plan. One of the Fed's proposals is to create a network out of TV white space. That's the unused broadcast frequency bands on television. Amy Nordstrom is here to tell us about that story and other short selected subjects in science. She's an associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum. She joins us here in our CUNY studios in New York. Welcome back.
Hi, Ira.
Let's talk about what is TV white space?
So TV white space is sort of the leftover frequencies that are available out there to be repurposed. So all the wireless communications in the world are broadcast over radio frequencies, and those frequencies are divvied up among different kinds of broadcasters. And this is usually done by a federal regulator. Mm-hmm. So, for example, mobile phone carriers, they get one part of the spectrum, radio broadcasters get another, and TV broadcasters get a third chunk of the spectrum. So the mobile phone space is getting pretty crowded because our smartphones are using so much more data these days. And so some people have proposed switching over to some of the leftover spectrum in the radio and TV channels. So why do we have all this leftover spectrum in the first place?
Thank you for asking my question.
I could tell that you were wondering.
And the answer is...
So traditionally, TV and radio channels needed some extra spectrum built in. They needed some extra frequencies built in between them in order to keep out interference from the channels overlapping each other. But we've moved on from analog technology to digital technology, and they can broadcast those channels on adjacent frequencies without any problem.
Uh-huh. So it's not going to affect TV broadcasts. It's not going to interfere with our TV broadcast.
Right. It shouldn't. And so... we have all this leftover spectrum on those two sections that we can actually repurpose. And one of the interesting ways that we can do that is broadcast wireless broadband signals out to places that have never had broadband internet before. So that's the proposal, one of the proposals that came out this week when I was attending some meetings in D.C. hosted by the U.S. State Department.
So how would this differ from the Google and the Facebook plans?
So it's interesting because there's a lot of companies with a lot of ideas about how to bring more internet to more places. So obviously they have an incentive to find new customers in those areas. But the State Department, through its initiative, is really emphasizing the tried and true technologies that we know will work. And this white space theory has already been in the works for a couple of years. Companies have already debuted a couple of devices that work in this way, and it's already gaining some traction. So I'd say we're a little bit closer in this strategy than we are in some of the loftier projects.
No balloons. So what will we have to do to move the needle a little bit further?
Right
to make
now,
it happen?
Sure. Right now, the U.S. State Department is really focused on this goal of getting 1.5 billion more internet users by 2020. But to do that, you need to get a lot of money behind the project.
Oh, money. So they're money. Yeah. I forgot money.
Do you want to guess how much money?
My calculator goes off the chart when I think of that. How many billions?
$450 billion is what the World Bank said yesterday. That's their estimate for what this entire project will cost.
Wow. All right. Let's move on then, because we know how soon that's going to happen. And we're still talking about the internet, but this time you're talking about it in space.
So there's this really interesting startup called Kepler Communications that is trying to basically add some infrastructure to space. So, you know, a lot of private space companies have been starting up lately and getting funding for a lot of ideas that revolve around the use of satellites in new and interesting ways. Satellites have gotten cheaper and they're very versatile. But these companies are inevitably going to run into a problem, which is that satellites can't easily communicate with each other or with the ground. So basically, the way satellites work is they orbit around the Earth, and then they beam down their information when they're over a ground station.
So these are not geosynchronous satellites.
These are the low orbit satellites that are orbiting. You're right. So geosynchronous are further out.
Right.
So for these low orbit satellites, they're orbiting the Earth, but they're only over a ground station every once in a while. Uh-huh. And so that's a problem and creates a delay in the time it takes to get data down to the ground. So this company is trying to create a space grid of other satellites that can basically network and always be over a ground station at any given time and always link up with all the other satellites. I think there's more than 1,300 now that are up there in low Earth orbit and sort of serve as this intermediary or infrastructure. You can think of it as an internet in space.
So this would give you 24/7 internet all the time, because all those satellites would be passing overhead at some time.
So somebody, like one of the customers of this company, might eventually try to create like an internet network based off of it that could reach to far corners of the world. But right now, this company is really focused on trying to serve some of the satellites that are already up there doing things like Earth imaging, space tourism. There's some efforts behind that right now. So they're thinking more about those applications at the moment.
Dare I ask a figure? Money for this one?
Well, they're not going to say, because they are raising money right now, and we don't really know what the cost will be. But the cost of these satellites has come down significantly.
Yeah, what about a project? Isn't there Iridium? Wasn't it an old project that has was supposed to have 77 satellites?
Iridium is legendary. Yeah. And satellites have gotten much smaller since then. So this project, right now, they're proposing about 50 satellites. So that's 5 each, 10 each and 5 orbital planes, which are slices of the sky that are sort of the most common orbits for satellites. But Iridium, it was using much, much bigger satellites to accomplish a similar purpose. And they were very focused on getting internet to remote corners of the world when they first started.
God, that was back in the ancient days of the 90s.
That's right. So you're getting deja vu right now?
Oh, yes, I remember. I think we have time for one more. Increasing carbon dioxide levels could be affecting the bees?
So there's this really interesting trend that, increasing carbon dioxide levels seem to actually have an effect on the nutritional content of food and staple food crops. So we've seen this in rice, we've seen this in wheat, and now these researchers out of the USDA, Purdue and the University of Maryland are seeing this also in goldenrod, which is a key protein source for North American bees, especially in the late fall, early winter period when they're getting ready to store over for next spring. So the researchers took 170 years of goldenrod pollen samples, and they analyzed them for protein content, which is what the bees are looking for in that pollen. And they found that the protein content had dropped by about a third over that 170-year period since the start of the Industrial Revolution. So it went from 18% to 12%.
Wow, that's a drop.
It is.
Yeah, so are we worried that that could be what's colony collapse involved here?
So they haven't actually linked it to either a bee's individual health or the population health. Right now, they're sort of thinking about that as a theory. It could affect the bees if they're not getting as much protein over time. Another option might be that the bees' bodies adapt over time and they are actually able to operate with less protein.
Well, we'll keep following that. Amy, thank you. Great stuff. Amy Nordstrom, Associate Editor at the IEEE Spectrum here in New York. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And today we're going to talk about the number of tigers in the world. Good news, it went up according to the World Wildlife Fund and the Global Tiger Forum. Their estimates say that there are 3,890 wild tigers, almost 4,000 wild tigers, nearly 700 more than their last count in 2010. So what could be bad about that? Well, here with both sides now is Sharon Guinup, a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She's also the co-author of Tigers Forever, Saving the World's Most Endangered Big Cat. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
So there's good news here, right?
Well, 3,890 tigers is certainly better than the prior estimate of 3,200, but keep in mind that there are 100,000 at the turn of the 20th century. And while the good news is that there are a few more tigers in places where they're well protected and have enough to eat, there aren't necessarily that many more tigers.
They're not that many. I mean, totally, there should be more tigers.
Well, it's more about the way they're being counted.
Oh, really?
In some places, countries are doing more accurate and wider surveys that are identifying, which areas to protect, which is great. But these new numbers aren't being framed correctly. Tigers were never systematically counted in Bhutan before, and India just started counting tigers outside of tiger reserves. So, if you're counting cats in areas that have never been studied before, that's not an increase in population. It's just better data.
And what's the biggest threat to the tigers now?
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit more about numbers.
Sure.
this isn't a dramatic turnaround for tigers. You know, China, Vietnam, and Laos showed single-digit populations, and tigers are extinct in Cambodia now. And some of these numbers are in question, including India's most recent count. The mathematical models that they used to estimate numbers were contested by one of the country's foremost tiger biologists, Ulas Karanth, in collaboration with Oxford University researchers. And some data is old. Nepal's numbers are from 2013.
Well, why is that? Are we just not going out? Is it hard to estimate the number of tigers that are out there?
Well, you know, they're, you know, spread in deep forest, often in large areas. And, you know, there's two ways to count them. Mm-hmm. The old, very inaccurate way, which actually is what Russia used, was counting pug marks. So if you're counting tiger tracks, you could count, you know, the same tiger five times and say it's five tigers. And India did that years ago and actually overestimated their population, like, by triple.
Right.
The more accurate method is to use camera traps that, you know, photograph tiger stripes, which are like a fingerprint. They, you know, definitively mm-hmm. identify individuals. So, no, they're not easy to count, but now they are doing, you know, more accurate and broader studies, so they are getting a better sense of true numbers. That said, there still are a few more tigers, but not the almost 700 that's being touted.
I can't believe how many there used to be. What was that number, 100?
There were over 100,000 tigers around the time that Rudyard Kipling penned The Jungle Book.
Wow. And they're down all the way down to that few thousand. Thank you very much. Sharon Guynup is Public Policy Fellow at the Woodrow Wilson, remember him, International Center for Scholars. She is co-author of Tigers Forever, Saving the World's Most Endangered Big Cat. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk lots more about, we're going with microbiologists to talk about the many mysteries of the Zika virus. How does it pass from mother to child? Knowing the right answer may help us develop a way to protect babies from the virus. It's microbiologist. Yeah, we're going to talk Zika virus. I know it's on everybody's mind, so stay with us. We'll talk about how it may affect the southern United States and the politics also in those southern states about women and their rights for reproduction. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced that there's finally enough evidence to draw a definitive link between Zika virus and microcephaly. That is the condition where infants are born with unusually small heads and brain damage. Here's a CDC Principal Deputy Director Anne Schuchat.
Everything we look at with this virus seems to be a bit scarier than we initially thought. And so while we absolutely hope we don't see widespread local transmission in the continental U.S., we need the states to be ready for that.
Are the states ready, though? Are we prepared to diagnose Zika in mothers here in the U.S.? Can we determine whether their unborn babies have been affected? And with closing of so many clinics in the South, where can women infected with Zika virus turn to end a pregnancy they fear might result in a deformed child? Also, there are Zika mysteries remaining, like the one my next guest has been studying, and that is, how does the virus even pass from mother to child? Carolyn Coyne is an associate professor of microbiology and molecular genetics at the University of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. She joins us from WQED. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Dr. Coyne, one of the things that I just mentioned that you've studied is how the virus might pass from the placenta, from mother to fetus, which is sort of a rare thing among viruses, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, overall, we know very little about how all viruses, even those associated with congenital disease, pass from mother to fetus. But I think in general, the thinking is that actually very few viruses are actually capable of doing that. And so there is something quite unique, I would say, about Zika that somehow has afforded it the ability to do that.
Do you have any clues about how that might be happening?
Well, I think right now we're still in the process of trying to establish even the model systems by which to test this, because pregnancy represents, I think, a bit of a unique scientific, at least model system by which to study this, because the human placenta changes dramatically throughout gestation. And so the placenta that is in a woman in the first trimester is actually very distinct from the placenta in the second and third trimester. And so, you know, some of our work so far has, I think, directly pointed to a mechanism of vertical transmission of the virus that does not involve the actual replication of the virus in the placenta cells themselves, which are called the trophoblast cells, at least in the second half of pregnancy. But it does not mean that that does not happen in earlier stages of gestation, let's say in the first trimester.
Now that the virus is beginning to appear in the U.S., and mostly in the South so far, do we have a quick way of diagnosing it in a lot of people?
Well, I think that's going to be the trick, because certainly we can look for the easiest way, I think, to diagnose this, of course, will be based upon symptoms in the pregnant woman, fever, rash, those kinds of things. And then, of course, after that, you can look for the presence of the virus or potentially antibodies, of course, in the maternal blood. Diagnosing, though, whether that infection has resulted in, you know, congenital Zika syndrome, I think will be a little bit more difficult, because depending upon the stage of pregnancy, depending upon the severity of the disease, such as microcephaly, but now we know that there are actually other congenital syndromes associated with Zika, could actually be very difficult to diagnose.
But the virus has been around a long time, and we've known about it for a long time. Why would we only be seeing these birth defects now?
Well, that's, I think, the big question, right? I mean, that's sort of the million-dollar question. And so as a virologist, I think you look at things like, okay, is it the virus that's changed? Is it the host that has changed? Or potentially is it both? And I think we don't know enough yet to really be able to pinpoint if it is not one or some component of all of those factors. We know certainly that the virus itself has changed. So the sequence of the virus that was first circulating in Africa is quite distinct than the virus that's circulating in Brazil right now. But we also, though, could say that, you know, there may be something very different about the women in Brazil, so therefore the host, that has somehow allowed them to become, and their babies, therefore, much more sensitive to Zika virus. And we just, I'd say right now, we have some just hypotheses and ideas, but we really don't have direct data.
Could it have something to do with timing, you know, when the infection happens?
It could potentially. I don't think it explains why that wouldn't have happened in other outbreaks that have occurred, certainly in more recent years throughout the world. I think certainly the microcephaly that we're seeing in a lot of these fetuses is likely to result from, you know, probably first trimester early pregnancy infection, simply because that is, of course, at the stage when neuronal development is most active and the developing fetus is most sensitive to anything that, of course, disrupts that process. However, we should keep in mind, though, that other pathogens and other viruses that are associated with congenital disease actually can cause microcephaly. So this is not something that is special to Zika. Toxoplasma gondii, rubella, cytomegalovirus, herpes virus in some cases. These viruses and as well as toxo can also induce microcephaly.
There are only about 20 abortion clinics left in Texas. There's one and for all of Mississippi. Are we potentially facing a situation where only the well-off, people who can afford to travel to get an abortion, to able to end their pregnancy if they suspect their baby might be infected with the Zika virus?
I think we absolutely could be, and I think that's one of the issues that I think has been largely overlooked when thinking about the fact that we now have the mosquito, or very soon we'll certainly have the mosquito vector that could certainly transmit Zika to Americans in the southern United States very, very soon, if not, of course, right now. And so I think those kinds of questions we have to start having an open dialogue about, that, you know, if women in early pregnancy in the United States are confirmed to have a Zika infection, you know, as I mentioned before, it may actually be very difficult to diagnose any congenital disease in those developing fetuses for several months in pregnancy. And if those women then make the decision to opt for an elective abortion, how will they do that? Will they be able to do that? Where can they go? And I think that that's a very, very important question.
Another abortion-related issue you're following is Tennessee Representative Marsha Blackburn and her effort to subpoena the names of any researchers even tangentially involved in fetal tissue research. She wants to create a public list. Is that going to put a chill on fetal tissue research, potentially important Zika-related research?
I would say absolutely. I think those kinds of things are terrifying to, I mean, certainly to scientists, but also to keep in mind that, you know, the list that is being curated involves not just the list of the principal investigators, but the members of our laboratories who are doing that that work. So students, young students, technicians, postdoctoral fellows, what have you. And, you know, so I think it's going to scare certainly the investigators who are leading these studies, but I think extending that list to the people in the lab doing the research is really quite frightening. It certainly is frightening to the members of my lab. Lab and to the labs of collaborators of mine that work in fetal tissue.
But, you know, it's interesting that this issue has come right into the teeth of the political system right now.
That's exactly right.
You know, you think this might be not just a national issue, but a local issue as well.
I think it should be an issue that we're all thinking about, certainly in terms of the political landscape, but also that we really, I think, just as a society, even beyond just the politics, you know, really have to start thinking about these kinds of things related to reproductive health, women's rights, and certainly, you know, with something like Zika, I think it's at least perhaps more quickly, you know, moved it into the forefront of our dialogue.
So what do you tell women in general who are fearful about getting the Zika virus?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think there's much we can say. And again, that's sort of the disappointing and scary thing about it at this stage of the outbreak, because we really know so little about that. And certainly, you know, I'm asked routinely as someone who at least studies, you know, the more reproductive angle of the vertical transmission, should I have a baby? When should I have a baby? And, you know, the issue is we just know so very little about this. We still don't know, as I mentioned before, you know, whether it is something unique in the host, so the Brazilian women that are somehow allowing the virus to undergo this vertical transmission that would not happen in the United States. And I think fairly soon we should begin to see whether there actually is a congenital Zika disorder associated with infection in American women. And if it's not, then I think that points us in some directions, I think very obvious and important directions, as to what could be different about women in Brazil.
Right. And who would be studying that?
I think we're all studying. I mean, I think a lot of us are studying it. Certainly the virologists are studying it. Those of us that are interested in vertical transmission of viruses, interested in how the placenta, which is this really unique organ in human biology, protects the developing fetus. So I think we're all really trying to, as quickly as possible, sort of assemble groups together to start asking these questions.
Well, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. We're going to certainly watch this. And as you say, and as you point out, this political season will be very interesting. I think this is going to be raised as we get into the summer and we see possibly more cases of the Zika virus. People are going to start asking about what we do about this, and hopefully our politicians will have some answers.
Absolutely, and I hope people do ask, and I hope people ask very loudly and very forcefully.
All right. Carol Coyne is an associate professor of microbiology and molecular genetics at the University of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. Thank you very much, Dr. Coyne, for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to move on to a new topic. So our next story is about a guy named Ian Burkhart. He's a business student at Columbus State University in Ohio. A lacrosse coach, too. But back in June 2010, he took a trip that would change his life forever.
I was on vacation with some friends of mine shortly after completing my freshman year of college. We were down in the Outer Banks, North Carolina, playing around in the waves, and I dove into a wave that then pushed me down into a sandbar. So therefore, the water was much more shallow than I thought it was. At that point, I had such a hard impact on my head that I broke my neck at the C5 level and damaged my spinal cord.
The accident left Ian unable to move much of his body below his elbows. But now, 6 years later, he has regained the ability to move his hands, pinch objects, pick up bottles, even play Guitar Hero. How is that possible? His brain has been wired to a computer that reads his mind, basically, and understands what he wants to do, and the computer is wired to the muscles in his hands, where it stimulates the muscles he needs to pick up that bottle or play Guitar Hero. Ian wasn't able to join us today. He's on the road with his lacrosse team, but we caught up with him earlier this week, and we'll be sharing a few of his thoughts throughout the show. With us now, though, is Chad Boughton. He's Vice President of Advanced Engineering and Technology at the Feinstein Institute for Medical Research in Manhasset, New York. He is part of the team that helped Ian regain those movements, and you can read about their work in the journal Nature this week. He joins us today from WOSU. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Bowden, I saw videos of Ian using his hands, and, you know, it almost looks like science fiction.
Yes, a lot of people, you know, make that comment, but we've really, I think, advanced in many ways in this field, and we're now really getting a better understanding about what happens when someone has an injury like this, and what happens in terms of brain activity, and how we can continue to record and even decipher that activity, and then link it to computers and different types of devices, like robotic arms, and in this case, even link it back to their bodies to help them regain movement.
So Ian has electrodes coming out of his head, and they go to what? Give us the pathway and what's going on here.
Yes. So Ian has a tiny electrode array implanted in his motor cortex, and it's in the area responsible for hand movement. And so this tiny array is actually picking up little electrical signals that are created by his neurons, literally, in his brain as he thinks about hand movements. Then we're feeding those signals into a computer where we have developed special software that actually can learn his brain patterns for the different movements and then can actually decipher or even, in essence, read his thoughts about those movements. And then from there, we take it into another system that was developed over the last several years to generate special electrical impulses that actually activate his muscles. And once his muscles contract, he can actually make the movements, all under the control of his own thoughts.
Huh. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So did he have to learn how to will those actions to happen?
Yes, actually. So since it had been several years since his injury when we began the study, it turned out in the first sessions, he really had to concentrate and focus to really kind of evoke the correct brain neuromodulation, as we say. And once he did that, however, the movements began. But he was often very fatigued mentally at the end of these initial sessions. And he has even said and commented that it was kind of like taking a six-hour exam. And he was just, you know, drained at the end.
In fact, we talked with Ian earlier in the week, and he talked about a lot about that. Most of us probably don't think about our movements much, but just want to move, right? And when we do it, but Ian sort of had to reteach his brain how to do this stuff and relearn how to move. And I'd like to play a clip of Ian describing that experience.
So it's something that I kind of had to break down and relearn how to make these movements occur. Because it's not really a natural thing to think about, okay, what muscles in my arm am I trying to move in order to get my fingers to extend? And then exactly what do I have to think about in my brain to make that happen? So it's something that for the first few months of using the system, I was, you know, I had to concentrate extremely hard. And in turn, after a session, I would be mentally exhausted to the point where I just wouldn't really want to do anything for a while, because it requires such a deep level of concentration to kind of learn how to do that. But now, you know, almost 2 years after the start of the study, it's getting to be much, much easier. The biggest thing is also without having any sensation in my hand, I don't really know when my fingers are all the way extended or if they're closed or anything like that. So I have to really rely on my sight. And we've been able to, you know, through the training process, either have one of the researchers put their own hand out and make the movement, and I kind of watch that and try to mirror that with my thoughts, or we do the same thing with a virtual hand on the computer screen.
Wow. How many cells in his brain did you need to tap into?
Well, you have to, you know, realize there's 100 billion neurons in the brain, give or take, and we're only listening to just a handful of those neurons. I would estimate the method we're using, we're probably listening in only on, you know, maybe a couple hundred neurons at the most, and just in and around the array itself. And that made it extremely challenging in trying to decipher between brain patterns for, say, flex the thumb versus, say, the index finger. or to make what we call a power grasp, to pick up an object like a water bottle, or if Ian wanted to do a pinch grasp to pick up a smaller object. All those brain patterns are slightly different, especially when you're only listening to a handful of neurons, as we are. So we had to develop machine learning algorithms, as we call it, in the computer that actually learn his brain activity. And over a period of about 10 to 15 minutes, the software actually improves itself and learns throughout that period while Ian is learning. So
wow.
So the machine and Ian are learning together. It's really amazing to watch.
All right, we're going to come back and talk lots more with Chad and also hear more from Ian talking about this amazing way to get the brain to control a paralysis. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about decoding the brain's thoughts with a computer and how that helped Ian Burkhart, a man living with paralysis, to regain movement in his hands. My guest is Chad Bowden. He's vice president of advanced engineering and technology at the Feinstein Institute for Medical Research in Manhasset, Long Island. Everybody, I'm sure you've gotten all kinds of feedback. How can you do this on me? I'm paralyzed. I have friends. I have relatives. We all know people who want to go through this. What do you say to them?
Yes, no, absolutely. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback, a lot of people asking where it's going and when it would be available on the market. It is in the early stages of development. We're still in that kind of learning stage, in the experimental stage. But we do believe we're making big steps forward, including these recent findings that just came out this week. And this is really the first time that that someone has been able to regain movement through the use of signals recorded from within the brain and then linked back to muscle activation in real time so that they're in complete control of that movement.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we're just at the beginning. We have many things to work through. Researchers that are in this field, are all kind of going or tackling different aspects of this. But I think, so it's hard to predict when it will be available.
What's the single biggest hurdle that you have to overcome?
Well, I think that probably the single biggest hurdle is to continue to develop better technology to pick up even more signals in the brain. We can't just be listening in on just a handful of neurons, if you will. We need to gather more signals so that we can pull more information out and allow someone to do even more complex movements and movements that would be useful in daily activity so they can regain an increased level of independence.
And you couldn't just give this same equipment to another patient, put it on his or her head and expect the same thing. You'd have to be individualized for each person.
That's right. We actually have to learn the brain activity patterns for each person. But we have developed ways to do that now. Just as was a little bit described earlier, showing a hand on the screen and allowing the person to kind of watch the movements and then think about those movements allows the user like Ian to be able to actually regain those movements typically in a matter of about 15 minutes. And this is something we developed through the years, but that's that idea of the person and the computer working together and learning together.
Yeah, did I hear you correctly? It just took him 15 minutes to learn how to move one part that he was trying to move?
That's typically when he comes in for a session. Now, this is after, of course, weeks of getting used to the technology and getting past that stage where he was mentally fatigued. But yes, typically he'll come in and within about 15 minutes, he can actually be up and running on a set of movements. Now, we also need to improve how many different movements can be done. Typically, we'll have a set of movements, as was shown in the paper released this week. But these movements take time. And over the months, he got better and better at more advanced movements. But yes, when he comes in, typically about 15 minutes to train on a set of movements.
Would you be moving to other limbs now also?
Great question. So we think that since we've now shown that it's possible to reroute signals from the brain around a spinal cord injury and to link those signals back to the muscles, in essence, we believe that it could not only apply to the upper extremities, the arms and the hand, but potentially one day even the lower extremities.
It sort of seems to me that this is turning out, and I may be wrong in assuming this, much simpler than you thought. It's the wiring seems to be much simpler than you thought.
Well,
or is it just the computing power so much better that you could the complex signals are with the computing power are easier to interpret?
Well, I think there's a number of factors. Computing power has gotten better. We've developed better decoding, as we call them, algorithms through the years to interpret these signals. I think that we also have learned that even after an injury, a severe injury to the spinal cord, or in some cases, say even a brainstem injury or stroke, that there's not perhaps as much reorganization in the brain as we thought, at least in the motor area where we are listening in on these signals. And so in Ian's case, even after several years, he was able to quickly relearn, if you will, how to think about these movements. And again, he's thinking about the actual movements, and we wanted to make it natural and as intuitive as possible.
Yeah, we have one more clip from Ian, whom we talked to earlier in the week. He seems remarkably hopeful about the future of these sorts of devices. Here's what he told us.
You know, losing the ability to use my hands has made a huge impact on my life. For me, being paralyzed, not being able to walk isn't the biggest thing. There's other things that kind of take precedent over that. So it's going to be something that a lot of people are going to have to work towards, and it's not going to be just one solution that one group is able to find. This might be something that takes years and years and years until it can be something that people are using outside of the lab and in their everyday life. So I'm just glad that I was able to participate in it and help kind of push that envelope even further, even if it's something that I won't get firsthand experience from. It's something that I know I've been able to help a lot of other people that have a similar condition to me. This is just firsthand restoring hope and showing people that we're not going to have to settle.
Very interesting. He mentioned in the earlier clip that the one thing he does not have is sense of touch in his fingers or limbs. Is that a challenge to you to try to make the information go in the other direction?
Yes. Right now, it is a one-directional or unidirectional bypass. But in the future, we do want to try to create a system that's bidirectional and basically taking sensory information and sending it back up to the brain and allowing that sense of touch and even what we call proprioception, where you know where your joint is in space and what position your hand is in. And that's so important. And I remember Ian, you know, commenting on that in the very beginning of the study, how it was a bit of an odd feeling, if you will, or lack thereof, when he went to touch and grab that first object. He could see it, but he couldn't feel it.
Wow. Do you expect that others now will follow you? Have you created interest in this field in other people?
There's definitely multiple groups working hard in this area, advancing different aspects of it. I hope this just will spark even more interest. Especially with young people that are pursuing their degrees and wanting to enter into this field. It's really a combination of biology and technology and medicine all together, and neuroscience, and it's just an incredible field, and it's growing at an alarming rate right now.
Yeah, I want to congratulate you and your whole team for the success that you've had.
Well, thank you. It was really a team effort, and I guess the star of the team for certain was Ian, and he really was an inspiration to all of us throughout this process.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Chad Boughton is Vice President of Advanced Engineering and Technology at the Feinstein Institute for Medical Research. It's out there in Manhattan at Long Island, New York. And we have that whole unedited conversation with Ian. We only played a couple of pieces of it, but the whole thing is up there on our website if you want to check it out at sciencefriday.com/Ian. That noise can mean only one thing, and that means our science club is back in session, and it's a good time for it because tomorrow is National Citizen Science Day, and we have the return of our science club back with a new project for you to try, and our science club founders, Ariel Zitch and Charles Berquist, are here. Welcome back.
Hello. Yeah.
What are we working on this month?
This month, we are asking all of you, listeners, to answer a question about something by sampling it.
Sampling it.
We want you to take a sample. So this is the Take a Sample Science Club. We want you to actually use a tiny portion of a thing to understand a larger phenomenon, something that scientists do all the time.
Charles, you want to expound on that?
Yeah, so we've got a little challenge for you, Ira, here.
A vase.
Just a second. Yeah, well, and, you know, because we know that you might be getting a little hungry. We brought some snacks here. Here we go.
M&M's, filling the vase with M&M's.
Love that sound.
Okay, so your challenge, Ira, is to tell me how many red M&M's are in that jar.
Oh, my goodness. I have no idea.
Right, so this is something, you know, it's a pretty big vase, and it's a pretty big bag of M&M's. And so it would be a real pain to have to go through and count all these one by one.
I'd volunteer to try and eat.
Okay, well, you can work on that on your own time. But, you know, if we take a sample of it, maybe pull out a random handful of, say, 10 M&Ms and see how many red ones there are in that handful. We'll probably want to do that a couple times just to make sure that we didn't randomly pull out, some unrepresentative sample where I happen to grab all yellow ones or something. But if you do that a couple times, you can then extrapolate and make judgments about what might be in the rest of the vase.
So if I wanted to figure out there were all different colored M&Ms in there, how many were yellow, how many were green, blue, I could take a sample of it.
You got it.
And that's what you're asking our listeners to do.
Exactly.
Not just with M&Ms, but anything they want to do.
Anything you're curious about. So if you've got a question about the world around you, right? If you got a question about, you know, the world inside of you, frankly, samples are the way to get at that question. What's terribly cool about sampling is that you don't actually need to count all the stuff or observe everything. You can take a sample and get an answer a question that otherwise would just be way too difficult or way too hard to observe exhaustively, okay? So, for example, most of you guys have probably already sampled things in your lifetime without realizing you were doing it. If you've gone to the grocery store and you pick up a melon and you're trying to figure out if that's a good melon, right?
Yeah.
You have a sense about what's a good melon by this point, Ira, right?
Absolutely.
Right. So that's because every time you've gone to the store and picked out a melon, you've looked at that melon and tried to figure out from that one melon sample what makes a delicious melon. So you've been sampling and you've used that sample to figure out kind of more about the melons of the world.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Here with our science club, Ariel Zitch and Charles Berquist, talking about this month's challenge is sampling. And yes, you're right. We have all in our lifetimes started to sample. But this time you want us to do it systematically.
Right. We want you to pick out something in the world that you're curious about that would take a lot of work to figure out in a straightforward manner. How many hairs are on my dog? You know, you can't
count. Poor dog. Yeah, it would be terrible.
Or, you know, maybe you want to know something about the way traffic goes past your house.
So you could sample something in time rather than objects in the box.
Right, rather than sit there all day for an entire week and count every single car that goes by your house, you could tell yourself, I'm going to take a picture of the intersection every half hour.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's not going to be a perfect representation of it, but it'll let you arrive at some estimates and make some conclusions about what the rest of the whole might be like.
So you could sample how many Chevys, Fords, and Teslas go by in 10 minutes and then see how many you think might go by during the day or something.
You got it. And you're probably going to figure out, as you guys have inferred, right, that maybe it depends on where you sample or how you sample what kind of answer you're going to get, right? So the number of Teslas that drive past your house might be different in different parts of the country than another.
Oh, that's
right?
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, and similarly, like if you wanted to go, say, weigh the average mass of a dog, Charles, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't go to the Great Dane Club owners meeting or something
like that. Right, or go to Chihuahuas Anonymous. Like that would not be a way to get an unbiased sample of, you know, dog mass, right? So take your sampling protocol into consideration. Think very critically as you answer your question with sampling.
Are we aiming this at anybody, everybody?
Everybody and everybody.
Teachers, students, scientists?
Yes, scientists especially. Scientists, send us your sweaty, weird field sampling photos and tell us what you were doing with those field samples. If you're a lab and you have samples as part of your lab and you do work on tissue samples or animal samples, whatever your thing is, tell us about it because we want to see how you use sampling and then we want everybody else to go try it themselves.
Mm-hmm. And do we have any rules to follow?
There are some rules I would recommend following. So please be, you know, lawful in your pursuits. Be respectful. Don't go trampling and sampling in private property. Try to sample things with their consent, which is code for, like, please don't accost animals or other living organisms and don't ruin them. But otherwise, it's pretty, like, open, right?
And how do they communicate with us about their samples?
So we're taking submissions online in all kinds of social ways. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. Our hashtag for the project is Take a Sample. And you can find complete directions on all the ways that you can get in touch with us on our website at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub.
You got it.
Could they send us little videos of what they're doing?
Please do. I would love sampling videos. That'd be awesome. I want to see what you've sampled. I want to know what question you're trying to answer with your sample. I want the, like, the nitty-gritty, no matter how ambitious or how subdued. If you just want to know, like, you know, like, yeah, yeah, how many hairs on your dog? I mean, that's a cool sample question.
And because in science, failure is always an option. We'd like to see if, you know, how well you're doing stuff.
Yeah.
Because we learn from failure, right?
Absolutely. And I've had my time with some bad sampling in my day. I mean, there's some people that have to sample some really unfortunate things. You know, like, people who study scat go in the field and they study the samples left by animals. And it's, you know, it's an incredibly powerful way to learn about animal ecology and foraging patterns, right? It might not be glorious, but it is informative.
And, you know, if you're a professional and you do this all the time, we know that there's a lot of hoops that you have to jump through to make your sample be statistically relevant and make those numbers actually tell you an accurate story. Right. And so if you're a pro, please tell us how you're doing that, too.
That's great. And we'll meet back here May 13th in a month.
Yep. You got a whole month to do some sampling. Check out our website. We've got even more projects that you can sample with as part of Citizen Science Day, thanks to SciStarter.
Right. So there you go. That's our project for the month. Ariel Zitch and Charles Berquist, thank you.
Awesome.
Thanks a lot. Ever.
And for all you science trivia geeks in the New York City area, we are hosting our second annual trivia night, and it's going to get dangerous. I mean it. At 8 p.m. on Wednesday, May 18th at the Bell House in Brooklyn, we'll be playing four rounds of pub trivia, all themed around dangerous science. It's going to be drinks, prizes, none of that's dangerous, a live band, and I'll be there. I'm pretty dangerous. Hoping to see all of you, so reserve a spot for your team early, and here's how to do it. Head over to sciencefriday.com/trivia for more info and to reserve your tickets because they're going to be sold out. That is sciencefriday.com/trivia, May 18th at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, and Christy Taylor. Luke Ruskin is our video producer. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners at the City University of New York. You can email us. Our address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. Go out and start sampling. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.